Members, we will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. We are one member short. Now we have a quorum, so we are legitimate. Representative Swedzinski, did you get a chance to look at the minutes from our last meeting?
Yes, sir.
Representative Swedzinski would like to move adoption of the minutes from our last meeting from the, I don't even know what date it was. From
that date.
The February 8th meeting. Any questions or comments, any concerns about the minutes? Seeing none, those in favor of the adoption of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Are those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you. With that, we are going to jump right into bills. First is Representative Tice, House File 792. And while Representative Tice is coming up, we had one of the other people that has a bill up, Representative Barr, who brought in treats because it's her first bill in front of the committee. So if when we get a couple of more people up here, we'll start distributing those and send a couple of things each way, and eventually they'll wind up at the end of the table and away from me. And with that, we will get to House File 792. I will move House File 792 so it's in front of us. Representative Tice, welcome back to the committee, and please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's good to be back here again, I think. I was told to start with a joke. I have no treats, so I'm not really feeling a warm fuzzy right now. But with that, you know, I'm not going to say a whole lot. I think it's about time we change the definition and of townhomes and put it up to the international code so that we are actually looking at the same thing. And while most think it doesn't have a lot to do with our local economy, it really does. We're seeing less and less townhomes being built in our areas, and yet when we didn't have some issues, they were actually going quite well in my community. And I'm not talking loud enough. But with that, I'm actually going to turn it over to the experts. And so with that, we'll start with Ms. Stone.
Ms. Stone, welcome back to the committee. Please proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate being before you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Remy Stone. I represent the Builders Association of Minnesota, a trade association with about 2,500 member companies statewide. We have been working on the issue of twin homes and townhome definitions for quite some time, and we are very pleased to have this issue before you because we think it gets to the issue of housing affordability and one of the most affordable, most desirable products in the marketplace. This bill is all about housing affordability and, quite frankly, code alignment. It's about correcting a code provision that has virtually eliminated an entire segment of new housing stock in Minnesota, the attached two-family, two-unit single-family dwelling, generally known or familiarly known as twin homes. And I am the one who put that little picture in your packet that shows you a housing unit, if you have that. Is it there? No? Yeah. It's a pretty picture. And I rhetorically ask all of you, can you tell me if that's a townhouse, a twin home, or a duplex? And quite frankly, under the building code, you wouldn't know unless you knew what the ownership piece was. So it's one of all of them. What this bill does is it establishes the traditional definition of townhomes as three or more single-family units, and by doing so, this will allow twin homes to once again become a viable product in the marketplace. During the last code cycle, the state deviated from the International Residential Code when it amended the definition of townhome to include twin homes. And what they did, and you have a copy of this also, is they replaced the word three with the word two. And by doing that, individual ownership properties of twin homes will now be treated as townhomes under the code. You also have a document that was prepared by the Department of Labor and Industry where they talk about what's the difference between a townhome and a twin home or a duplex. The department itself identifies that there's really no definition for twin home and that that it really is all about ownership and placement of utility lines. And because of this rule, the class of ownership rule that we have, We've made twin homes all but extinct in Minnesota. To put this in context, the month prior to Minnesota adopting the 2015 residential code, and again, I stress this is about residential code. This is not IBC or commercial code, but this is for residential properties. Prior to that, 46 twin homes were permitted and built in the city of Moorhead. After this rule became effective, 2 were permitted and none were built. This is being repeated across the state. What this means, however, for the folks in Moorhead is that they're no longer able to access the most affordable product in a twin home, and Fargo reaps the benefits of Minnesota's regulatory environment. Most of you, and I'll just go right at it, most of you are familiar with the sprinkler mandate, and I'll be blunt, this is one of the largest cost drivers for a twin home. However, there are other cost drivers that come into play when it comes to treating twin homes like townhomes. And these cost drivers include separate utility services, braced wall panels, over-engineered vapor barriers, sealants that are needed to pass blower door tests that are not at all related to the actual energy efficiency of the product, but actually related to the small scale of these homes and the volume that's within them. You may hear some objections to this bill because of concerns that this is a fire safety issue. It is not. Minnesota has not experienced residential fire deaths in new homes since the code started requiring interconnected battery backed up smoke detectors. And in fact, the very nature of these smaller properties makes exit generally quicker, and there's only one shared wall. Something to note about these shared walls, in attached dwellings, most builders install a wall system to prevent noise transfer. It's a consumer demand. And these wall systems that are put into these homes exceed the 1 and 2 hour burn rates that are required under the code. So by consumer demand on noise, we're already installing a wall system that exceeds fire rate concerns. I could go on. I'm sure you may have questions about this, but I would like to close with a reminder about what the state building code is all about and how it's supposed to be adopted. The Minnesota Court of Appeals gave us these words recently, and it said, provisions of the building code must be based on the application of scientific principles, approved tests, and professional judgment. We know that there is no evidence that treating twin homes as townhomes under the residential code justifies the cost related to building them. This is especially true when you realize that a twin home can be built like the more affordable duplex simply by changing the class of ownership and what you call it. In fact, I would venture to say that our building code itself is discriminating against those who are desiring to purchase an individual twin home rather than choosing to dwell in a duplex. And with that, I'll be available for any questions, and I know you have a series of folks who want to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Mr. Vagel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. James Vogley, I'm with the Builders Association of the Twin Cities, here today in support of House File 792. I'll keep my comments brief, but do want to point out the local impact in our housing market here in Minneapolis-St. Paul. Aligning this definition with the standard national definition will increase affordability. It will increase access across multifamily, residential housing. When we say multifamily, we mean townhome, twin home, and condominiums. This matters. Right now, we are looking at a housing market that struggles to provide affordable options. 10 years ago, 57% of the homes built in the market were multifamily. Today, just 15%. This bill is part of a series of solutions, a host of initiatives that we are supporting this session, and we'll go a fair way to having more options for homeowners and, frankly, the most affordable options. So we encourage the committee's support and are happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Vogley, and my apologies for mispronouncing your name earlier. I had like 15 or 20 years of people mispronouncing my last name. I'm still trying to get even.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for this kind of impromptu me joining the committee hearing here. I was just notified it was going to be up about a half hour ago, and so I just wanted to make some comments on this bill, because this bill really is very important for my district, for Moorhead. It's about affordable housing, and quite frankly, it's about people my age getting into some of their first-time homes. I had called the Home Builders Association of Frogamora just to print up some stats, and compared 2014 and 2015 twin home starts in Moorhead, we had 48 each year compared to 4 in 2016 after this new definition was adopted. And then compare that to Fargo, where we had seen 30 and 52 respectively in 2014 and 15 twin home housing starts, and then 82 in 2016. So just taking a look at some of those numbers, I think it is pretty evident that this specific policy is, you know, pushing people, especially, like I say, looking for those first-time homes to the west side of the river. So thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Representative Lean. Members, any questions? Seeing none, I know Chief Lamont, if you want to come down. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please identify yourself for the record and start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Wayne Kiewicz. I'm the fire chief with the City of Ridgefield, and I'm with the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association. With me is Kip Lamott, who's the fire marshal for the City of New Brighton and is part of the Fire Marshals Association of Minnesota.
Welcome.
Thank you. We're here representing the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition, which in addition to our two organizations also includes the Minnesota Fire Department Association and the International Association of Arson Investigators, the Minnesota chapter. First and foremost, we oppose House File 792 because it bypasses the normal statutory rulemaking process that is established in Minnesota. Construction codes are developed through an open consensus process in which all interests are represented. Builders, building officials, fire, everyone's at the table. While on the surface this may seem like a simple definition change, it will have a domino effect through the code. We believe that it's imperative that this be handled through the normal rulemaking process where the implications can be vetted via committee with all industry professionals. Some are concerned that residential sprinkler requirements adversely affect the cost of housing. The National Association of Home Builders stated in 2015 that the average home costs just over $103 per square foot to build. The National Fire Protection Association published a study in 2013 that said the average cost of installing a residential sprinkler system was $1.35 per square foot. That's approximately 1% of the cost to build the house. This puts the cost of a fire sprinkler system, the most effective safety system available, in line with the cost of a deck or a fireplace. One of the reasons we're so vocal about fire sprinklers is that there is a very large, very significant fire problem that is developing in our country. Despite advances in technology, or quite possibly due to some advances, there are significant fire problems in today's residential environment. Today we furnish our homes with primarily synthetic materials, polyurethane foam, furniture made of chipboard and other materials, many of which are petroleum-based. Look around today. The chairs you're in, polyurethane foam, synthetics. They're petroleum-based. You're basically sitting on solidified gasoline, which in a fire is a very bad thing. According to research conducted by the National Institute for Standards and Testing, Underwriters Laboratories and the U.S. Fire Administration, they burn hotter and faster than the materials 30 years ago. In past years, you had approximately 20 to 30 minutes from the start of a fire before the fire reached flashover, the point where the entire room is engulfed in flames. Now you have less than 4. Granted, as far as we're aware, there have been no deaths, fire deaths, in a home in Minnesota with interconnected smoke alarms, but that's not the case nationwide, and that is going to happen here in Minnesota eventually. It's just a matter of time. There's a school of thought that installation of residential fire sprinklers should be a decision left to an individual homeowner. While we vigorously disagree, many argue that if a home burns, it's only the homeowner who is affected. It was their decision not to install sprinklers, so the buyer be warned. Many use this argument as to why they support sprinklers in apartment buildings, but not for one or two family homes. We would posit that this holds true for not just apartment buildings, but also townhomes. Should there be a fire in a single unit, the other unit or units will be affected. Owners have no control should a neighbor's negligence cause a fire. And additionally, most townhome owners will not have the ability to make a decision in regards to fire sprinklers, as most buyers will be purchasing a completed unit. The decision will have already been made for them. Once again, we would prefer that this go back through the normal rulemaking process that has been established and in process and works very well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Keywatch.
Committee members, I really have nothing to add. Wayne did a great job with his.
Okay. Thank you. I just didn't want to cut you off if you had something to add. So, members, any questions? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a slightly different point, but I figure I'll ask you and maybe the prior testifiers want to comment. My city has expressed concern about just the administration of the code, that sort of it's sprawling enough and then having to look in statute to find exceptions and things. I guess this connects with the first comment that you made about using the process of having. So I guess I'm wondering if you could comment, and I'll ask the testifiers, maybe I have to ask them to come back, but about the administrative side of things. I don't know if you all handle that, but the need to sort of not just look at the code, but now you got to look in other places to try to find exceptions to the code. Where it says two in one place, but now it says three in another, that kind of thing.
Chief?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto. I'll be honest, I do the fire marshal stuff in Richfield. If you ever really want to, you have a hard time falling asleep, pull one of the code books out. They refer to this section, to that section, to another section, and back and forth and around, and it's very confusing. And for us to have to go start to look at statute would add a whole other level of confusion to the process. I would also state that should this go through the rulemaking process and get changed in the next code iteration, we will have to come back to the legislature to get it changed again.
Thank you, Chief. Representative Pinto, does that answer your question?
It does from this testifier. I guess maybe this is a question for Representative Tice. It's just asking why is it that the process, why is it that it wouldn't have gone through administrative process, why it needs to be a statutory change in that way.
Representative Tice, or do you want to have Ms. Stone?
And my apologies for not asking earlier.
That's okay. We're here to get answers. It's fine. Representative Tice, or do you want to have Ms. Stone?
Mr. Chair, I can put my two cents over phone, but I would love if Ms. Stone would come down as well. Having been in the building remodeling industry for many years, I think what we're looking at here is just a definition, to clarify a definition. I know I was here, was it last year or the year before, and changed the code cycles to 6 years. So we're looking at it, you know, quite a few years to change that code again. And when you hear the numbers and the stats that these homes are not being built, that's an urgency. It's an urgency to many communities, and you heard Representative Lean say the same thing. It's really making a difference in what's being built out there and having the housing available for folks. My husband right now is doing home inspections, and we hear from the realtors all the time. There's not enough housing available. But yet here we are with the definition that is actually stopping some of those new homes being built for folks. And you're seeing a lot of seniors as well going into twin homes. In fact, if you go to a lot of the aging areas, they're twin homes. Right. And they need something that's affordable. And they need something that needs to spring up pretty soon, too, because there's a lot of moving around. So that's basically my concern, to make sure that we keep the building industry going. I mean, I'm not really wanting to change the code as much as I want to change a definition so that we can go forward and do some more building.
And Mr. Chair, so my understanding is it could be a couple of years before the code would be changed regardless. Right now the definition, I guess, is in the code. So then having the statute change the definition, if I'm understanding you right, it sounds like there'd be a couple of year delay.
Ms. Stone, do you want to come down and handle that one?
Certainly. So, Mr. Chair and members, the code cycle that we're on, we will see the next full redraft effective 2021 if we're lucky. So, you know, we have an urgency in housing stock, and we would expect, because the rule is now online, that with a direction from this body to the revisor's office, the rule would be updated. And quite frankly, even the agency publishes, and that's one of the documents you have, even the agency publishes opinions and updates how the code is to be interpreted, and you'll notice that on the back of that page, they're already advising the community about a change that was made through the Court of Appeals in 2015. So there's ways to get the word out.
Yes, Mr. Chair. First, our final piece on this. So I guess so when my city has this concern about kind of the administration of this, something you're saying, for this, it should be pretty simple. Most likely the code will get changed based on it, and then it's not that complicated.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, I would reiterate, this isn't a change in the technique of building these homes. It's a change in the definition. Yeah. So administration should be fairly straightforward.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems to me, well, first off, my fire chief.
The name drop.
Yep, okay. And it seems to me that there's not much urgency here. If this has been a problem for years, why haven't we come at it from a point where the safety issues can be dealt with rulemaking? Why is suddenly there's this urgency if it's been something that's been worked at for years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Slocum, actually, the definition of townhome up until the effective date of the 2015 code has always been three units or more. So this is a one-year situation, and in fact, it went up through adjacent to a different lawsuit before the Court of Appeals. And while the Court of Appeals struck down a portion of the rule that affected one and two single-family homes, they left in place this piece that affected twin homes, and that happened at the end of 2015. So this is our first full and ripe session where we can address this issue here.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Representative Slocum, does that answer your question?
Well, it troubles me that the state, excuse me, Mr. Chair, thank you. It troubles me that the safety issue, and when I have a neighbor who burns stuff, it troubles me there too. But he burns building supplies, building materials. It smells horrible. It lights up the sky. He's building some big ones. And that stuff's dangerous. It's dangerous to breathe. It's dangerous for the firefighters to fight the fire when it gets out of control because it goes whoosh pretty quick. Why can't we go through the normal rulemaking procedures to do this and do this in a way that respects the safety issues?
Ms. Stone or Representative Theis? Ms. Stone?
Mr. Chair, Representative Slocum, again, you know, we're looking at a long horizon for the rulemaking process. We don't anticipate the agency is going to open this rule up anytime soon. We know from experience in our adjacent states who all treat townhomes as three or more units that the experience on safety concerns does not exist. And quite frankly, we're just going back to a product type. You could be asking the question, is this a duplex or is this a townhome? And I would garner that many of our public safety officials wouldn't know if it's a duplex or a twin home just by looking at it on the outside.
Chief, do you want to weigh in on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to point out is that there are two definitions of a townhouse in the two different codes. The Minnesota Building Code refers to, or in Minnesota Building Code, right? The IBC refers to it as three or more. The Residential Code refers to it as two or more. Both of those rules went through the rulemaking process, were brought forward, passed by the legislature, and became the code in Minnesota. It's not just how the homes are built. If they want to do a two family townhome, they can build it under the IBC. If they do two or more under the residential code, it requires fire sprinklers. That's what we're really talking about here, is fire sprinklers. We're talking about 1% of the cost of building this home, and you're talking about a system that is going to save lives. It's not the construction, it's the stuff we're putting in our homes. I can't emphasize enough how damaging and destructive a fire is. And when you have, let's say you're, well, townhomes, they're two separate owners, right? Correct?
Yes.
So you have your property, they have their property. Your neighbor's negligent. They have a fire. Next thing you know, you're out of your house for 6 months to a year.
Thank you, Chief. Representative Davids was first, then Hillstrom.
I'll pass, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's actually what I wanted to get to, the crux of this. So there's two separate codes. So the difference is ownership in this definition based on the two different codes. So explain to me in clear, understandable language the difference between who has to have sprinklers and who doesn't have to have sprinklers and why things are not able to be built because of these two definitions. Why is one so difficult to follow and the other not?
Chief?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, it's my understanding that that the building code versus the residential code, the building code is more stringent, requires more non-combustible materials to be used, and it's the stuff most commercial buildings are built of, apartment buildings and things of that nature. The residential code is primarily single-family homes, townhomes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to follow up then, for the most part, this would, changing this definition would allow homes that would otherwise be owned by one person to be owned and rented, or they would typically have been owned by two people previously. Explain to me what this definitional change actually does to the ownership requirement of the property.
Chief.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, it doesn't change the ownership. It only has to do with the additional, as I mentioned earlier testimony, the domino effects of changing the definition. As we all know, words matter. So changing this definition would eliminate the sprinkler provision in two-unit townhomes, which is, like I said earlier, went through the rulemaking process and was adopted. And as as Ms. Stone said earlier, that was brought forward as part of the lawsuit regarding the residential sprinkler issue, and the court decided to not rule on that.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tice, the legislature decides about the rulemaking process, and you talked about how you changed the timeline. So now we have a six-year code. Couldn't you have just changed the timeline again if you thought this issue was so important to be changed immediately and have the rulemaking process start again on a shorter timeline if you wanted this definition to be changed?
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Hillstrom. One of the reasons why I wanted it, why I worked to change the code to a six-year, is that it's costly to implement the code and to get everybody up to speed, to get the books, to do all this stuff. And it really was costly to have this done. And that was the reason we made it a little bit more reliable in saying it's going to happen no sooner than 6 years. So to change it again, just for a definition, just really seems like I'm going backwards so far. And one of the things you learn in doing work with this codes is the interpretation is so broad from place to place. And to have something that would really address what a townhome is and what a twin home is, it doesn't sound like it's a big deal, but it is in the building world. There is a very big difference between a townhome and a twin home. And that's why I think this is a better way to do it, rather than wait and see our market decrease, our buildings slow down. Representative Lean talked about it, how it really changed how building happens in his area, in Moorhead. I can't see why we would want to continue to keep this process slowed down.
Ms. Stone, to this point?
To this point, if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom. To be clear, we approached the department last year after the Court of Appeals decision came down, asking them to fix this, because if you read that case, it is clear that the court is confusing twin homes and one and two single family homes, okay? So there's just general definitional issues going on. When we asked the agency if they would be willing to open this up, because the commissioner does have the authority to do emergency rulemaking or amendments for technical issues, we were instructed that the agency was not inclined to open the rule up to deal with this definition.
Representative Hillstrom, and then we'll go to the chief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there actually is a process in law, an emergency rule, that would allow this definition to be changed if the if there was consensus that the issue should be changed. Bad case law makes bad law. And here's my concern, members. We set up a process by which the building code process is supposed to be stable. It's not supposed to be political. It's supposed to bring the parties together. We've lengthened the time so it's more stable. And now I might want something in the building code, and Representative Tice, you are setting a precedent that it's okay for me to bring my pet project to the legislature to change the definition in statute. I don't think that is the direction this legislative body wants to go. I thought we wanted more stability in the building code, which is why you extended the timeline to 6 years. I think it's clear that there is not consensus here. Otherwise, the commissioner has the authority to open the definition.
Chief?
Mr. Chair, we are not opposed to an emergency reopening and having this go through the rulemaking process on an emergency basis. Not at all. We would welcome that.
Thank you, Chief. Representative Hillstrom, you're good?
Well, Mr. Chair, if that's the proper place, and you just heard that there is not an opposition to it, I think that's probably the better process than this, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Allen, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the two issues. One, first comment on the rulemaking. So I'm not persuaded that it seems to me with the court case that the court reviewed the rulemaking process and decided that the administrative agency did not make a reasoned determination and that it was arbitrary. And so not that we don't always necessarily make reasoned determinations here or decisions that are not arbitrary, but if there is, to me, the only one thing that makes sense why that, because it's not persuasive to me, the 1% cost, if that's true. But if there's uncertainty in the building code, then that makes sense why contractors are reluctant to build something. So if that is the case, that there is some uncertainty, then to me that could be why there's such a drastic reduction. So I have an open mind about it at this point and believe that the legislature can make a reasoned determination in this case, and that I agree with you that if it goes to rulemaking, that's just going to languish and that they would be somewhat hesitant on getting struck down again by the courts.
Thank you, Representative Allen. Members, any other questions? No. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? With that, I think we've had a pretty good discussion on the bill, and Representative Tice will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This really is an urgent situation for our building industry, and you can see it by the amount of permits that are pulled. It makes a big difference to what's happening in our state. I don't want to get caught behind. Because again and again, you hear from economists that if our building industry isn't doing well, our economy isn't doing well. And here we're taking homes, I don't necessarily want to say away from folks who are first-time buyers or seniors who are looking to move to a place that's a little easier to take care of. It's very concerning to me, especially being on the Aging and Long-Term Care Committee. We're very interested in getting more housing for folks. So with that, I ask you to please consider all the information that you've heard, and I hope that I can get your vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice and Representative Lean, Ms. Stone, Chief Kiewicz, and Representative, Fire Marshal Lamont. I'm not sure what the right title is, but I appreciate the discussion we've had and the testimony we had from everybody, Mr. Vogley. With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 792 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to jobs. Thank you, members, for a good discussion on that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Barr, House File 587. Representative Barr, if you want to go ahead and move House File 587,
yes.
It is going to be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs as well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to do that, but before doing that, I would like it noted for the record that I did bring treats for the committee rules.
Representative Barr, I would suggest that you check the minutes at the next hearing and see if that's reflected in there.
And for those coming after me, the first time you present, I've also been informed there are some sugar-free folks here, so bring carrot sticks. Not sure that that will go over very well, but...
Okay, we might be going a little far afield here, Representative Barr.
Okay. Well, on that note, I'll move House File 587, and I'll also invite Mr. Peter Bricletti, who's here with the Department of Commerce, down, and I will also have another testifier, Mr. Chair. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Davis.
I'll move the A1 amendment. We don't want that. I rescind my motion to move it.
That would be my amendment, Representative Davis.
I like moving your amendment.
Great. As long as it passes.
Representative Barr.
So this bill is on unclaimed property. I think most of you know that. And what the bill that I'm proposing does is to help us be more proactive in actually getting taxpayer dollars back into their hands. This fund has grown significantly over the past 10 years. In fact, it's doubled from about $350 million to now it sits at $695 million as of the end of December 2016. The bill that I have put before you proposes a couple of things. One, it's proposing that we contract with an outside provider to assist with getting those dollars and assets back into Minnesotans' hands. And as a business owner, I'll tell you, when I'm piloting something or proposing that clients pilot something, I always propose that rather than hiring FTEs, that they use a third party, either contract employees or a contract vendor. And that's why I'm proposing it here. These assets, if you look at them from a business standpoint, are aging. You know, they sit with a certain institution for a period of time. They come to the Department of Commerce for a period of time, and so they get dated, and we need to move those assets, and by hiring a third party, we have a better chance of hiring someone with specialized expertise in placing or identifying owners of those properties. The second thing is providing a list of owners on the Department of Commerce website. Currently, those assets are listed on a website called Missing Money, and I would just like to see if anyone here has gone to that website and whether or not you have any funds, because I can tell you there are people in this room that do have some funds. So, yes, I see two hands, and there's actually another person in the room that also has some funds. So the point is we're putting those lists out on missingmoney.com, and we still have people even in this own room, pretty savvy and sophisticated people who have funds out there. I will tell you for the record, I looked, there were no funds for me out there. So, but I would like a list alphabetically on their website. And the reason is Missing Money website is a little bit cumbersome. And you have to go in and add first name and last name. And when you have a list that's listed alphabetically, it makes it easy and kind of fun, quite frankly, to go through to see if you're on the list or others that you might know. I'd also like to see more accountability around advertising. In looking at some of the record and the past success of the Department of Commerce in getting those funds into Minnesotans' hands, there was advertising involved. And I know some folks are like, okay, you know, most people are online these days. Do we need newspaper advertising? And I always use my mom as an example. She's 75 years old, and believe it or not, she does not have a computer. She doesn't have email. I'm excited that she has a flip phone, which is an upgrade. And so my mom would not be able to find assets. She does access, in my hometown of New York, a paper called The Penny Saver. And so I would be looking for advertisements in local papers, particularly for assets greater than $500. Also, doing some more to publicize these assets for those people who actually are on the internet, not unlike my mom. You know, we can do more with internet advertising, social media, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, those kinds of things to try to promote and get those dollars back into the hands of Minnesotans. Also, I would like to see more reporting around and accountability around what's happening with those funds back to the legislature. And also putting together a report. You know, I would like to see a report provided for each member of the legislature listing the people in their own district. Because quite frankly, we are the closest to the members of our district, and quite frankly, I would love to give money back to people and members in my community. So those are the key components of the bill that I'm proposing today. And before we take questions, Mr. Chair, I think I would turn it over for some comments from Mr. Peter Bruckwitty and other testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Barr. Mr. Bricletti.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department. My thanks to Representative Barr for bringing this bill forward. We have, at the department, supported similar legislation in years past that's been brought forward by a bipartisan group of legislators in both bodies. The unclaimed property program has been a success story for the state. In 2016, in the last fiscal year, we had a record-breaking year on all fronts. We returned over 30,000 claims to Minnesotans valued at nearly $50 million, all done without dedicated resources at the agency for claims return, which we view to be the primary focus of the program. Representative Davids, let me see if I can convince you to offer the A1 amendment after all. I think we are supportive of Representative Barr's efforts on increased advertising and certainly reporting to the legislature about the methods with which we use, and many of the methods that we've talked about. Representative Barr was just talking about newspaper advertisements. We have done that in the past, and at the legislature's direction, two bienniums ago, we have done some social media work, and we have worked with individual legislators to provide them with lists of community members in their districts that have property. What we are not able to do is to do that in a sustained way because we do not have statutorily dedicated funds to process claims. What we do have is statutorily dedicated resources to bring unclaimed property into the state in compliance with Minnesota's unclaimed property law. That has been the primary driver for the growth in the fund since 2011 when the legislature appropriated those dedicated resources. That's when you've seen the largest amount of growth. Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, similar legislation has been brought forward previously. Last year, there was a bill at the legislature that we did a fiscal note on. That bill had appropriation for two FTEs at the Commerce Department that would be specifically dedicated to returning funds to consumers. The fiscal note from the department was $165,000 for those two FTEs. The bill, as it is here before you, which would allow for a vendor, third-party vendor, to get up to 7% commission, we have concerns about for two reasons. One, that 7% commission is on top of the cost of the program, so 7% of the nearly 50%, if you do the calculation, on the nearly $50 million that we returned last year, that's $3.5 million approximately, compared to $165,000 if we had dedicated staff at the agency. There are finders, third-party vendors that work with consumers in Minnesota and across the country in unclaimed property programs across the country today. They typically don't work for consumers for less than 20 to 25% commission, so we have concerns that if we were required to fully turn over the return of property component of the program to a third-party vendor, and they were only the commission structure was set at 7%, that we may then struggle to return any property at all. So I'm looking forward to working with Representative Barr and the Newspaper Association. Again, a lot of really good things in this bill. We'd like to continue the conversation as we move forward to jobs on the method in which we are returning property to consumers, but that is the ultimate goal, which we share. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. And I know Mr. Anthonson wants to come up, but we had a couple of member questions. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question. Back in 1998, I lived at a house in Duluth when I was going to college, 705 Woodland Avenue, and I worked for Super America. And when I left, apparently they couldn't find me or something, and my paycheck went to the unclaimed fund. To this day, I still have not been able to prove I lived at that address because I've lived in many homes during my stint at UMD. Now that money has, I'm no longer listed on that website anymore. So could you explain, because I'm sure that if it's happened to me, it's probably happened to other individuals where they can't prove that they lived at that specific address during that time. And possibly that has disappeared from the unclaimed website as well.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is not the story in which you describe living in a place and then having a property that is not able to follow you as you move through different residences is not an uncommon one. It surprises me to hear that you would not be listed any longer. I'd be happy to work with you directly on that issue to try to claim that property. Property is available in the unclaimed property account, is available in perpetuity to the proper owners. I can tell you we are currently working on a project that involves
cooperative utility in the Redwood Falls area that went out of business in the early part of the last century, and we are now working on processing claims that are sometimes third or fourth generation heirs. So, again, the property is available in perpetuity. Happy to work with you directly. I don't know specifically why it wouldn't be on the website. That surprises me, and we'd be happy to track it down.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier or the author, this isn't just cash, right? It could be other things, and we got a staff show this to me. It can be real property, like this is a military medal, and it could also be rebates from companies that issue rebates that never get redeemed, because I think that goes into escheatment and then on from there. Is that right?
Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. There is both real property held in a vault. It is less exciting than you might think. There's a lot more baby pictures and locks of hair type things.
It's not all metals?
No, sir.
Oh.
Mr. Chairman, it's if you think about what people typically used to put in a safe deposit box. It's the things that you consider to be valuable. It may not have a tremendous monetary value, but it may have sentimental value. In addition, you're correct, there can be rebates, all sorts of, you know, everything ranging from life insurance policies to utility rebates. Anything that is held by a company that ultimately belongs to a consumer but is not ultimately returned because of any various issues, including what Representative Franzen described.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, and just because I'm apparently in love with Minute, or at least the idea of Minute or stuff, how would this be done? Would you do an online image catalog that could be claimable through Minute, through your own webpage? How would that be done, and do you have the capability of doing this today?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we are required by statute to have an auction at least once every 10 years of real property that's held in the unclaimed property account. The most recent auction was in 2014. We're actually working now on, that was an in-person auction. In this day and age, there are a lot of more efficient ways to do that, so our hope in our next auction would be to do something that would be more online-based, that would expand our reach to consumers, not just here in Minnesota, but around the country, to increase our scope.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how, then, would you give 7% of photographs and other items? How would you determine their value?
Mr. Representative Barr.
And as part of the process of looking into this, I have been trying to determine how much investment income is actually earned on that property. So that property is earning income, $700 million. It goes into the general funds, and the thought was that we would potentially redirect some of those funds to actually turning the funds back over into the rightful hands.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is, how did you come up with 7% given that, for example, the Department of Public Safety, when they are dealing with administration of grants and those kinds of things, can only charge 2.5%? How did you decide on 7%?
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The statute regarding unclaimed property actually allows for up to 10%. And I would defer to staff because I don't recall what the statute is. But so it would be within the realm of what's already in statute.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You also state in the bill that the money that is returned, that the 7% shall not come out of the abandoned property or the money. So would it come out of the budget of the Department of Commerce, or where do you get the money from if you are not taking that 7% from the value of the abandoned property?
Representative Barr, is this, and Representative Hillstrom, maybe the question is for you. So are you looking at the blank appropriation on the back page 3 of the bill?
Mr. Chair, I saw the appropriation, the blank appropriation. I assumed that that was for actually the administration of it. I didn't realize that you intended to potentially set aside $3 million, which would be 7% of the current amount of money that's sitting there.
Well, I can let Representative Barr answer this, but I asked, I don't know when, but earlier about, not during committee, about the appropriation. And this bill, if it passes here, is going to the Committee on Jobs, where the Commerce Department budget is. And I, Representative Barr, are you working on a fiscal note, or Mr. Brickwitty, is there?
We will be working on a fiscal note as this moves through committee. So, yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, did that answer your question about the 7%, or is that a...
Mr. Chair, my main question is just, so you're planning to allocate dollars from the general fund to pay a vendor to send people back their money. You're not planning to have the money come out of the unclaimed property that's sitting, that someone else's property. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment whenever you're ready to hear it.
Okay, I think we've got a couple of more questions, and then we'll get to that. Representative Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I first want to follow up on what Representative Hilstrom asked. I guess I'm still confused. So if $50 million in cash and liquid assets gets transferred in a given year, but also some metals and locks of hair and other things, how do we figure out what the vendor gets paid if it's 7%? Is 7% of $50 million, or do we have to actually value those individual pieces being transferred?
Representative Barr.
Mr. Chair and Representative, right now I want to refer back to that these assets, and I think the majority of the assets are actually cash assets or other funds that are sitting on the general or in the general fund as a liability, as stated by Mr. Briguetti, that need to be paid into perpetuity. Those assets are earning interest every year, or investment income, whatever you want to call that. And when the property claimer accesses those funds, they do not get any interest. So that interest on their assets is going into the general fund, and I don't think it's unreasonable to propose that we spend some of that general fund income to actually get the property owner back to into the hands of the owner. And I'd also like to make a point that part of the reason for the growth in those funds is the statute was changed. It used to be that private companies had up to 7 years to turn that over. We decreased that to 3 years, and I think with that, we have more need to be accountable. We have a fiduciary responsibility to do something to get those funds back into the hands of the owners.
Thank you, Representative Barr. Mr. Briguetti, do you want to weigh in on this? Can you shed any light on how it's currently handled?
Mr. Chairman, first off, thank you for that promotion. I would say, Representative Pinto, I think a couple of things. As I read the legislation, any real property would need to be appraised, and I think a vendor would be able to receive up to 7% of the value of the abandoned property if that abandoned property was returned to the owner. So, for example, Representative Nash, if it was a military medal or, say, a Babe Ruth baseball, which I think was the most highly valued real property item at the last auction, that the vendor would receive 7% commission on the value of that real property. To the issue of funding source, and I want to be conscious that this is probably more an issue for the jurisdiction of the Jobs Committee, but the unclaimed property account is held within the general fund, and while the general fund is at least in part, an interest-bearing account, because, as I understand from MMB, a portion of the general fund is invested by the State Board of Investment in order to cash flow state government. The unclaimed property dollars and any dollar inside the general fund is a non-dedicated dollar. So, for example, licensing fees paid to the Commerce Department, which also go into the general fund, are also non-dedicated dollars. So I think, and I would defer to my colleagues at MMB and the State Board of Investment. I wouldn't want to speak for them, but at least from the Commerce Department perspective, it would be extremely difficult to attribute, say, a dollar of interest earned to a dollar in the unclaimed property account as it goes into the general fund, as I understand.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm still trying to circle back, though. Here's the thing. My understanding is the percentage is then intended to give an incentive to the vendor because they'll get a percentage of the money. So I'm wondering, how would the percentage be calculated when it comes to real property? It's not 100% liquid assets, right? There are metals and things. My understanding is right now we don't need to appraise those things. Under the amendment that we'll be voting on, we wouldn't under the amendment we would not need to do that. But it seems like I'm just wondering, would we need to do that under this bill as proposed? If the answer is no, then I don't know what incentive the vendor has because they don't get any cash when those real property get handed over. If the answer is yes, then that's adding an additional step we have to do, which is to appraise all these things, metals, locks of hair, other things.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Unless I'm misunderstanding.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, when the department prepares an auction of real property, those real property assets are appraised and valued. So we do that step today. I think where we have concerns at the department level is this 7% commission that would be paid is on top of the total cost of the program. So,
but Mr. Chair, that auction happens.
Well,
Representative Bino, I think what's going to happen, if I'm running an auction company and I have a Babe Ruth baseball, I can assign a value to that and expect to get money, so I'm going to go out and try to find the owner. If it's baby teeth, how do you sell that? So I don't expect that the company that's trying to claim the 7% is going to be out there selling baby photos or baby teeth or whatever it is, and I think they're probably going to wind up being there in perpetuity until the next auction comes up.
Mr. Chair, I guess as I'm reading the bill, the vendor gets 7% of the property when it's returned to the owner. So with the baby teeth, the vendor has no incentive to return it to the owner. With the amendment, the full-time employees of the Commerce Department have an incentive to return to the property owners, including the baby teeth that they may care a lot about. Well, that's what I'm trying to get at.
Well, Representative Pinto, what I'm trying to say in a nice way is there's no value to baby teeth. So they're not going to get 7%. You can get 7% of zero.
And Mr. Chair, I guess my point is, for the family that would be looking for those baby teeth or the metal or whatever it is, they care about it, and under the amendment, as I'm understanding...
But Representative Pinto, we're not on the amendment yet.
Okay, but my apologies.
Okay.
But Mr. Chair, I guess what I was asking about is just trying to understand the calculation, and so my understanding is there would be no, it would not be included in the 7%.
And Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman, 2 points. Representative Pinto, I think I understand your point, and apologies that I didn't get it right away. I would say the real property auction is a very, very small percentage of the total amount of property that we're talking about. The commissions that would be paid on the unclaimed property that is returned on an annual basis throughout the year, the dollar amounts, or the values, I should say, of those properties are much larger typically than what we get in the real property auction. And Mr. Chairman, you're very well informed, but we do indeed have a collection of baby teeth in the unclaimed property vault. So,
and Mr. Brickwoody, far be it for me to ever say that those don't have value. They don't have monetary value. They're of enormous sentimental value to somebody. But members, we have two more questions, and then we have to get to Mr. Anthonson and more questions. Representative Kreisha. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question was about the return on investment. So, Representative, you stated that there's interest that's being paid on the money that is sitting in the Department of Commerce. Is the return on investment 7%? Does the money that's sitting make enough money if we just use the interest in order to pay the bill that you're proposing for the private vendors?
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I would love to answer that question to you, but I had a very difficult time after several weeks of inquiring about that, so I'm not able to answer that question. We'd have to get someone from the SIB to come in and testify to that. So,
Representative Barr, you know who loves people from the SIB coming in to testifying? Representative Garofalo does. Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, just whenever you're ready for the amendment.
We got one more testifier, and then we're going to go to the amendment. Mr. Anfinson. Mr. Anfinson, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed when you're ready.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members, Mark Anfinson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. Just a couple of brief comments. We support Representative Barr's bill for two reasons. One, the general reason that this strange and untamable beast, this incredible unclaimed property fund, sooner or later should be dealt with. It's $750 million now. It's grown by $150 million net in the last 2 years, and in about 3 years at the present rate of increase, we'll hit $1 billion, and that's all money that belongs to citizens of the state. So it's a good idea in policy terms, we think, to enact a framework by which to deal with that. The second reason we support the bill is a more specific one. The bill provides that some of the money expended by the Department of Commerce to find people who are owed property will be via newspaper advertising. Now, some might respond and say that's not just a specific reason, that's a selfish reason. Well, I wouldn't say that, because there's a lot of evidence, and I mean a lot of very specific evidence, that newspaper advertising has historically been one of the most effective ways that specific individuals have learned that they have property with the department. And so the bill proposes an advertising project that will notify more people. So we think it's a great idea. I wish I had the barnstorming capacity of Representative Atkins to fully explain to you just what a wonderful idea this is, but I won't try and replicate that. But this is essentially a renewal of the project that Representative Atkins pursued for the last few years, and I think most folks felt he made a pretty compelling case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there's something in the water in that district. members, questions for Mr. Anfinson? Seeing none, Representative Hillstrom, the A1 amendment?
Thank you.
Representative Rosenthal, I can see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anfinson, you referred to Rep. Atkins' bill and advertising in newspapers, but I don't see how this makes it any more. You liked Representative Atkins' bill, it sounds like. The only difference being that we've had $165,000 for two FTDs, and now we're going to pay $3 million. To me, that makes no sense. And I'd like to hear your comment on why you like the Atkins bill and why the difference in this bill makes it better or worse in your
opinion. Mr. Chairman, Representative, we did support the Atkins bill. We liked it because, again, it provided for, among other tools, newspaper advertising. We don't take a position on the specific mechanism by which the owners of this property should be located in the property return. That's a decision for the legislature and for the department. I will say this, and I'll say it emphatically, as we've worked with the Department of Commerce for the last few years to try and craft a mechanism that would be effective, that would deal with this beast, the department and the newspaper association have had a very cordial relationship, and the department is really looking for an effective solution. It's a bit of a complicated problem, but again, we don't take a position on that specific issue.
And Representative Rosenthal, I think what our goal here for all of us is to try to bring more exposure to it, and I don't remember the numbers that Mr. Brickwood said.
Just be very brief.
Yeah, the big spike was because Representative Atkins was out there really pushing for this, mm-hmm. and I think if we pass this and we have somebody, the private firm that's out there digging and trying to get me people their money back, I think that will be beneficial. Representative Rosenthal.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Mr. Anfinson, this actually is for the department. Do they currently do newspaper advertising?
Mr. Brickwood.
Mr. Chairman, again, Peter Brickwood from the department. Representative, yes, we have done newspaper advertisements. The department is required by statute to spend 15% of the annual budget for the Unclaimed Property Program on advertising. So, for example, there was a rider in the Commerce Department's budget two bienniums ago that required us to spend $25,000 in each year on newspaper advertisements. We did that. This year we are engaged in a small newspaper ad buy on community community of color newspapers, trying to increase our outreach to those communities which have traditionally not been served well by the program. So we are attempting to do as much as we can with the resources that we have and trying to explore new ways of reaching Minnesotans to alert them. I can tell you other states have massive advertising budgets. The state of Massachusetts advertises at professional sports events. We don't have the budget for that.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, members, there's a couple of things that I have some concern about in this bill. I'm a supporter in general of the concept of doing this. I supported Representative Atkins' bill. The AA1 amendment takes us back to Representative Atkins' bill, and it designates two full-time equivalent to doing this work instead. And instead of a vendor, it reinserts the commissioner. So, members, I would like to offer the A1 amendment. But, members, one of the reasons why I want to do this is partially the drafting of this proposal. In addition to staff being not costing $3.5 million, if you actually look at line 1.18, it says that the vendor must receive up to 7% of the value, not may, not go to the lowest responsible bidder who is going to do a good job, not if they reach an amount higher than what the department already does. This says even if they just do what the department is doing right this second, they're going to get 7% of the money. So members, first I'm going to offer the A1 amendment, and if that fails, I've got an oral amendment, Mr. Chair.
Well, that is good news. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Bauer, do you want to speak to the amendment? Or members, is there a discussion, questions for the author of the amendment? Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, do you want to hear from the bill's author first?
Representative Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to comment on a couple of things. We're throwing around this $3.5 million, and I want to comment on the assets that were returned last year, which was the record high for the department, and all due respect to the department because I know that they worked hard to do that. Someone mentioned that they thought it was in large part, and I do agree with the efforts of Joe Atkins. He was on a significant PR campaign last year, and I think through his own efforts alone in our district over a three-week period, he helped return $300,000 back to our district. So I applaud the efforts, and there was significant PR, editorials, articles, online, in printed publications, in addition to the advertising. Advertising last year, I don't know if you mentioned this number, according to what I received, was $64,000. So I don't think the return on those assets was solely related to the advertising. I think it was definitely related to some of the efforts of my predecessor. So that's number one. Number two, the reason I think it's critical to look at an outside vendor and pay up to 7%, not pay, and I will happy to correct the word like must, representative, is that these assets are more complex. If they were easy to return, I would hope like heck that they would have already been returned, either by the company who held those assets originally or by the Department of Commerce. So I think we need to keep that in consideration. If I might, Mr. Chair, also say that I am not in support of the amendments, and I would respectfully ask people to vote against it.
Thank you, Representative Barr. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask representative from Commerce what the average, because I understood $50 million may be kind of high, what the average amount is.
Mr. Brickwoody.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't have the average dollar value for a property returned per fiscal year. I could get it for you. I would generally agree that advertising drives to the program. So the effort that Representative Atkins, Representative Hansen, and Senator Metzen engaged in was one that helped move the program. But I can tell you, because we helped track that for them, a couple of things. One, the department still needed the resources to be able to process the claims. So you can do all the outreach you want, but if we don't have staff to actually process the claims, then not only does do the claims not get property don't get returned, but the customer service experience for the consumer suffers greatly. And I can say that the return rate on Representative Atkins, Representative Hansen, Senator Metzen's effort was about 25% based on the 1,000 letters that they sent out to constituents indicating that they may have unclaimed property. The department's return rate last fiscal year, was almost 50%, which beats the national average. So we know how to do this work. I absolutely agree with Representative Barr. These are typically complex properties, oftentimes involving air claims and a lot of proof that's necessary in order to make a claim, especially if you're not the original owner. We know how to do it. We just don't have the bodies to do enough of it to get money back to consumers.
And so, Mr. Chair, I guess, and members, I didn't speak in favor of the amendments. Just to say that even if it was three times as big last year, that still would be $1 million payment to a vendor as compared to $160,000 payment. And the vendor would not have an incentive to return those baby teeth, the metals, the things that can't be liquidated, unlike the employee. And finally, it sounds like 7%, in addition to being in some ways too high, because it would create this much higher cost, in other ways, from the prior testimony, it sounds like it's too low, because the typical percentage would be 25%. And so I wonder if the vendor would end up taking it. So I'd speak in favor of the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I did some personal outreach to some of those vendors, and I disagree with the statement that Mr. Brickwedding had stated, and I know for a fact that there are vendors out there that would work for much less than that, and so I'd like that just reflected in the record.
Thank you. And Representative Pinto, good question. I had the same question, and we have our committee administrator here has from the governor's budget, there is a program narrative from the Department of Commerce, and it has a couple of graphs in here dealing with unclaimed property returned and unclaimed property claims paid, and we can get copies of that to you. Otherwise, I'm sure, like everybody tonight, we'll be at home reading the governor's budget. So, Representative Barr.
One last comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I do want to say that there is a precedent for the Department of Commerce to hire outside vendors because they actually use a third-party vendor at the front end of the program.
Thank you, Representative Bauer. Representative O'Driscoll, let's... Oh, Representative Hillstrom, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what do they pay to that vendor as a percentage?
Representative Bauer.
I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative, I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Brickwood?
Mr. Chairman, I'm actually not quite sure, Representative Bauer, to what you're referring on the front end of the program. So I don't know if I can answer. I don't know if I can answer the question right this second.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Barr.
Thank you. If you go to your website on the front end of the page and you follow through for unclaimed assets, you provide a page to people who are turning over assets to your organization that you're using a third party for. So that's where I'm talking about. There is some precedent with the program overall.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barr, thank you for that clarification. We do utilize a third party. Vendor system, which is the unclaimed property system, electronic system that we use. So the department would be happy. Don't know the contract value off the top of my head. I'd be happy to provide that with you. I will note that the governor's budget, in part, provides some funds to the department to potentially upgrade that system. It is called Wagers 2000, which should give members a sense of how old that program is. But that is a program that we help that we utilize to administer the program, but not necessarily to go out and bring money in. It's our accounting system, if you will.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwood. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. In the spirit of brevity, I will just make this comment. In the past, and maybe members have done this, and I did it as recently as last week, ran in my weekly update this very topic with a link, and if you figure that there are 201 legislators, and if on average that legislator had 250 people subscribing to their weekly update, which I would assert is low, you're reaching over 50,000 Minnesotans by that. Just a way for us to be able to make an impact as legislators without having to bring on full-time equivalents in the Department of Commerce and doing our jobs directly with our constituents by informing them accordingly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have supported this effort historically. I was supportive this time, and I'm very supportive of this amendment. The more I'm hearing about kind of bang for the buck, two employees from the Department of Commerce to do work that they're already capable of doing, they just need, essentially more bodies to do the work. That seems like it makes a ton of sense, particularly with, as Representative Barr said, the fact that we have some interest that's going into the general fund. So it really seems like the opportunity for that to pay for itself is very realistic. It's clear we're not gathering $3 million from the interest, but certainly that would go far, I think, to offset staff cost. So I strongly urge members to support the amendment. I do have a question with regard to the vendors, and since Representative Barr, you mentioned you've talked to these folks, who does this? I mean, I'm really curious about who hangs out their shingle or how this is incorporated into a business model and who does this work in Minnesota.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I'm not an expert on it, but I can tell you, if you just do a Google search, you can find some names of companies. So there are companies that specifically work on returning unclaimed assets to owners. And also you will find that a number of large financial institutions actually have different areas within their departments that do also some of that kind of work, also at the front end, trying to help their clients so that those assets never have to come to the Department of Commerce. And then they also do some work around that. So there's quite a few companies out there that do that kind of work. My intent with doing the research was just to make sure that those organizations were out there and not to undermine the department. I would expect that they would determine how they would do an RFP and what kinds of assets. I would suspect that they would RFP out the more difficult assets to place and have their staff focus on some of the easier claims to resolve. So, again, that would be for them to determine how they would RFP that out.
Thank you, Representative Barr. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my concern is about the consumer protection aspect of it. So if we're, it makes more sense to me to build a, have to fund the to the department to build the capacity to have to increase activities, or whether it's through ads or through other types of programs, or but the consumer protection aspect worries me, because unless you're going to have Commerce regulate the actions of the private vendor in their contacts with the those that are missing money. But this whole issue of unclaimed property, I mean, it's a whole part of the scams of on elderly, and where they send them emails and say, you know, we have unclaimed property, but if you just send, you know, email or wire this money, then you'll get this back. Or so it doesn't, if it's a Department of Commerce that's contacting me, more likely to believe that it's valid than a third-party vendor, somebody that, and that could be easily be a fraudulent company claiming to be this third-party vendor and working with the population. So it doesn't make any sense to me that we would contract this out, that Commerce Department. I mean, you haven't said anything about what the regulations, what standards would govern how this money is going to be, how these people are going to be identified.
Representative Barr and Mr. Brickwood, let's see what happens with the amendment. But Representative Barr, as you go forward with this bill, I think that Representative Allen's comments should be well taken and look towards making sure we're protecting all of us, that you know, especially seniors, to make sure that it is somebody real and we're protecting people from fraud. With that, Representative Hillstrom will give you the final word on your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, this is just taking the bill back to Representative Adkins' original bill. I have long supported this concept. I just believe that if we can do it with staff, it's much cheaper than this must pay 7% of the value of the property. Members, I would ask your support.
With that, Representative Hillstrom moves the A1 amendment. Those in favor of its adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion does not prevail. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I'm going to offer an oral amendment.
Can I guess what it's going to be, Representative Hillstrom?
Mr. Chair, I might surprise you. It's going to be on line 1.18. First, the word must should be may instead of must. And, Mr. Chair, given that we only permit our agencies to claim up to 2.5% for administration, I would like to delete 7% and insert 2.5%. That is what we, again, allow our government to administer. These are also government funds, and I believe that is the appropriate amount. I'm opposed to an outside vendor, but I didn't win that vote. And so, Mr. Chair, this is the fiscally responsible amendment, and I would ask for a roll call on this one, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, before you ask for a roll call, is there any chance, because more is better, that you'd want to separate that into two different amendments?
I think it would probably be divisible, Mr. Chair, if you would like. If folks want to do may, I want the vote on the 2.5 versus 7%.
Representative Hillstrom, that's what I was assuming, and I'm also assuming that the may might be okay with the author. And that I don't know what she would think about the 2.5%. So if that's okay, can we do the may? Representative Barr?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Would you regard changing must to may as a friendly amendment?
Yes, I do.
Representative Hillstrom, is that okay with you? Ms. Pompoo, we have the change from must to may. I know it's a hard one, but we're just double-checking. Those in favor of this amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. I appreciate that. To your next amendment, changing on line 1.18 of the bill, changing 7% to 2.5%. Did I get that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, the reason for this is, again, this is the amount that we allow agencies to use when they administer funds for grant purposes. And I would ask for a roll call.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Davids.
What is the department's position on the Hillstrom Amendment?
Mr. Brickwoody.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, I think, I think that the 7% is problematic because it's increased costs on consumers. So the 2.5% is less problematic. It is still increased costs to consumers for the program. Certainly saw the vote on the previous amendment, so I'll maybe leave it there, Representative Davids.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, just a procedural question.
Where is this committee going, or where is this bill going after this?
I can tell you where I'm going after this, but not the whole committee. But Representative Crucia, this bill, should it pass, is going to go to the Committee on Jobs.
And I'm just wondering, to help the bill author out, I mean, it sounds like there's a little bit of discussion to happen yet. What if we were to find a way just to move this through? And I don't know if, if we do need to do a roll call, we need a roll call. But it sounds like a discussion offline or in between committees would probably solve this. Maybe we want to do it in committee, but I just think there's an opportunity that this could be worked out before it hits the next committee if the author were to give her word.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, there are so many folks in this body that are fiscal conservatives, and I want people to put their money where their mouth is this time.
Okay. Representative Crucia?
So partisan.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Rickwitty, could you ever see, if this were to stay at 7%, that you might, in your department, cap it out at 2.5%? First part of question. Second part of question is, would there ever be an incentive that you might want to offer an above 2.5% to try to clear the inventory of assets that you're holding on behalf of the citizens of the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Driscoll, I don't believe if the language had stayed must, I don't believe we would have been able to do that. With the change to May, it's possible. I don't know. I would want to talk to our contract attorneys to see if that would be possible, but that is an interesting idea.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Representative O'Driscoll.
I was just also looking for the second half of the question, which was, did Mr. Brickwitty ever see that the department might want to offer an incentive to return the property to the people of the state of Minnesota and offer an incentive higher than 2.5% as proposed by the amendment?
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, Representative O'Driscoll, my apologies for not responding to the second part of your question. I think I'd want to talk to our contract attorneys, and that could be something that potentially could be put into an RFP. I would add that we share the goal of returning all property to Minnesotans, so if I had enough staff to be able to do that, we would be doing it today.
Thank you, Mr. Rickwitty. Representative Anderson. Well, we have discussed this amendment at length. We have not heard from the bill author. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for your amendment. And I am going to respectfully ask again to leave to vote against this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Barr. Members, any other questions on this amendment? Representative Hillstrom, it's your amendment. We'll give you the final word.
I've had said enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. And just so everybody knows, I think everybody understands, but before we vote, on line 1.18 of the bill, we're changing 7% to 2.5%. That is the Hillstrom oral amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Hoppe.
No.
Representative Fenton.
No.
Representative Allen.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Davids.
No.
Representative Franzen.
No.
Representative Helverson.
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Crucia.
No.
Representative Loon. Representative Loonen.
No.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No.
Representative Pinto.
Yes.
Representative Rosenthal.
Yes.
Representative Slocum.
Yes.
Representative Swedzinski?
No. By a vote of 7-12, the amendment does not prevail. With that, we're back to the bill. And we've talked about the bill a long time, and we'll get the member questions. But before we do that, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to come down and speak for or against this bill? Not seeing anybody. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to follow up on my previous question because through the magic of technology, I did hit the Internet to find some of these vendors and didn't find anything based in Minnesota. I found a lot of online-based vendors and would really like more information. I don't need it now in terms of who these vendors are that would handle such a thing for the state of Minnesota, and are they locally based or are they based outside of Minnesota? I think that's important for us to know in terms of who handles this kind of business.
Representative, thank you, Representative Halverson, and Representative Barr, you might want to look at that before jobs. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as we have regulated coin dealers, we may want to find out if there's any regulation or background checks required for people who are going to handle $50 million or more of the state's money in a given year. We want to make certain that we know who it is that these folks may be.
And I see Representative Barr taking notes, so... Good point. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Representative Barr. Members, any other questions? Seeing none, the Representative Barr will give you the final very brief word.
Okay, the final very brief word. I believe that we owe it to our citizens to find many times and many ways to try to return their assets back to them, and I think we can do better than we're doing today, and I would like to respectfully ask for your vote on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barr. With that, Representative Barr renews her motion that House File 587, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Members, thank you for a good discussion. We're on to jobs with that one. Representative Davids, you are up. House File 212. Representative Davids moves House File 212 and moves that it be referred to the committee on to the General Register. Representative Davids, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill makes a technical amendment to the Consumer Right to Advice Law that was passed in 2015. That law ensures that consumers have the right to be represented by a licensed insurance agent when dealing with health insurer. The change in the bill simply amends statutory reference from a qualified health plan, which can be interpreted to apply to only plans sold on MinSure, to the broader term of individual health plan, which includes any individual health plan, not just those sold on MinSure. This bill does not require carriers to pay a commission on Medicare plans when an agent is not Medicare certified, because if an agent is not Medicare certified, they cannot be talking to people about Medicare plans. Federal Medicare certification requirements remain in place for this bill. Those requirements are a complete waste of time and have driven thousands of qualified agents from the market. This bill is not about MinSure, but simply amends the statute to align it with its original intent. So what happens, members, is you will have plans are called qualified plans, and it's some have interpreted that a qualified plan can only go through MinSure, but there are offline plans that are sold to individuals, so an agent can represent a client when dealing with a health insurer. That's simply what the bill does.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Is there anyone else that wants to speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anyone. Members, any questions? Not seeing any. Representative Davids renews his motion that House File 212 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Representative Lunan. Representative Lunan moves House File 909 that be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs. Representative Lunan, let's go. To you, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 909.
Please proceed. Thank you.
Members, this bill is a bipartisan bill that what it does is it recaptures funds that are collected when someone has full coverage on their auto insurance. There's a 50 cents every 6 month charge for auto theft prevention. And what happens is back in budgetary tough times, that fund, $1.3 million of that, was reallocated into the general fund. What this bill does is looks to reappropriate that back towards or much closer towards the reason it is originally being collected for, and that is to fight insurance fraud. And so what we're asking to do is to reallocate it back into the Commerce Fraud Division. And the reason for that, first of all, the auto theft portion, one of the things that's different today than when this was first enacted is because of the electronics, the GPS items in cars, auto theft problem is a much different situation than it was back then and is in much better control. However, insurance fraud is actually going the exact opposite direction. Back in 2007, there was 909 cases referred to the fraud division. In 2016, there was 2,227 cases, which basically causes the Commerce Department to have to do a triage because they can't handle the caseload and to prioritize, and in some of these cases, probably not act at a level that they would like to. And so this is a straightforward bill. I know the chairman puts a priority on an effort towards peace in the valley, and we have that. This is one of the few bills that the department and the carriers and everyone agrees that this move makes sense. And so what the funds would be used for is to hire licensed peace officers in the fraud division to go out and fight the bad guys.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. You are correct. We do appreciate peace in the valley, that and brevity. Those are our favorite things. We haven't had a lot of that today, but we've had interesting bills. Representative Lunan, thank you. Is there anyone that wants to speak for or against this bill?
Not that I know of.
Not seeing anyone. Members, any questions for Representative Lunan? With that, Representative Lunan, nice job. Representative Lunan will renew his motion that House File 909 be referred to the Committee on Jobs. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lunan, and thank you, Representative Davids. With that, Representative Rosenthal. Representative Rosenthal moves House File 879, and I believe I will double check this, but I think we're sending this to the Committee on Jobs. Been a very jobsy day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to say, Mr. Chair, this is a first for me. I've never received a bill hearing without requesting one before, so thank you very much.
Well, Representative Rosenthal, we knew you'd want one, and we tried to be efficient here.
Thank you, members, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. This House file is a small step in a very, very growing problem on senior fraud and vulnerable adults and their caregivers, and it's something that is going to grow and grow and grow. And what this bill does is appropriates $500,000 to do a statewide outreach program, radio, newspapers, going into nursing homes and doing some trainings, and then reporting back to the legislature on January 2018. Just a sort of personal experience with this. My mother is older, doesn't really understand how things work. She, in her local newspaper, she read an article or a advertisement for somebody that was buying silver, and her caregiver and her looked this company up on the internet, and they thought, oh, it's on the internet, they got to be legit. And turns out that this guy was a crook and took all the silver without making payment, and it took me a long time to get it back. But so this problem is growing, and I think it's something with the silver tsunami coming, and this was Susan Allen, Representative Allen, makes a great point. We want people to be protected, and we want them to have the information that, you know, keeps them safe and keeps them financially whole. And I do have some testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Commissioner Rothman? Commissioner, welcome back to the committee. Please proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you all, and thank you for inviting me to speak on this important subject. I definitely want to thank Representative Rosenthal for authoring the legislation. During my tenure as commissioner, I've traveled all over the state of Minnesota, and I consistently hear from seniors and their loved ones about the threat of financial fraud and abuse. In fact, I was at the Apple Valley Senior Center just yesterday. We had about 70 people, including the county attorneys, the local law enforcement, and just to hear the stories themselves from these people is phenomenal, and it's everywhere. We also were at an event in Rochester the week before on Friday and heard not only similar stories, but we also are there to help, and we give them information about how to protect themselves. Above all, Minnesota seniors want to know what they can do to prevent fraud, what they can do to stop it, and what they should do if it happens, meaning they should report it. At Commerce, we have stepped up the investigations. In fact, as I started, it's one of my top priorities, and it's our phone centers and also our investigators have made it a top priority, and to make sure that if we hear about financial abuse against seniors, we will stop it when we see it, and we will put people behind bars and help them get justice. We also know, though, that once we're at that investigation point, the money's gone. The victims have already been hurt. Their families have been abused, and there's problems. And so one of the best things to do is to do what we can before. Minnesota seniors are vulnerable to financial abuse. One out of five seniors, it is estimated, has been a victim of financial fraud. Older Americans are defrauded out of nearly $3 billion every year, at least as what's reported, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. Seniors, as you know, can be vulnerable due to isolation, cognitive impairment, decline, or physical limitations and health problems, and they're the targets. Seniors are the targets of criminals, fraudsters, and it's clear. The seniors are, this generation, have the greatest amount of wealth in U.S. history, and the criminals know that. And they're not just people in Minnesota, they're people, criminals around the country, and from other countries. And the threat is going to continue to grow as seniors retire at the age of about 10,000 per week. So let me, you've seen, there's an article that is in your packets about the Heath case, but I have a few others just to give you an idea of what's happened. Most importantly, each one of these cases is about somebody who did something bad, but they committed these frauds and scams against victims, against our parents, our family. They've taken their money, they've taken their life savings, and they've taken the money that people need to pay for health care, to keep the lights on, and all of that. And it makes it extremely difficult for all of us. So I thought it'd be good to describe several recent cases that we've worked on and dealt with at the department. A few years ago, we took action against Jeffrey Rod from Redwood Falls. He was a former police officer and a host of a radio talk show called Safe Money Radio. He also had a business as a financial consultant who sold investments. The department took action against Rod after receiving a complaint from a resident in the Redwood Falls area who had not been repaid on an investment as promised. So it was clear, not clear, but it was out. The potential for a Ponzi scheme was clear. The investigation found that Rod had solicited investment funds from four Minnesota seniors, including one who was suffering from dementia at the time of the investment. Two had invested their entire retirement savings, including the proceeds from the sale of a farm. In the end, Rod was convicted in federal court of fraud involving a total of nearly $2 million that he swindled from his victims. His Safe Money Radio was the exact opposite. People's money was certainly not safe with him. He used the power of the airwaves to establish trust and then abused it to rip people off, period. I got on the air. The station called me and asked if I would get on. It's not in my talking points, but I went on the air. The radio station apologized for giving this person the platform they did. And then the next week, we got additional complaints from other seniors and other people in the community about having been ripped off by Rod. Sean Meadows. Sean was another recent case of a financial professional exploiting his clients. Sean, at the end of this one, I want to also call out and praise financial professionals, and I'll tell you why. Sean Meadows of Eden Prairie was sentenced to 25 years in federal prison for using his financial planning and asset management firm to operate a long-term Ponzi scheme in which he stole more than $13 million from at least 100 individual victims. Meadows pretended to be a trusted investment advisor, but he abused that trust by lying and stealing from his clients. His victims are spread across the state, Alexandria, St. Cloud, Nisswa, and in the metro area, Eagan, Maplewood, Moundsview, Oakdale, Minnetonka. Instead of investing his client's hard-earned retirement savings, he spent it and bankrolled his own extravagant lifestyle. These were some bad things. He went on trips and all of that. But he robbed his victims of their lifetime savings and of their peace of mind and their dreams of a secure retirement. Financial professionals, in this case, actually, we received a report about him, but we've also been training and working with financial professionals around the state who are the front lines of often the people who report these problems to us at the department. So here's a good example of that. Financial professionals or a financial advisor contacted the department to seek help with a senior client who was suddenly trying to cash out a pre-tax annuity worth $250,000. The client said she needed the money to pay advance taxes and fees from winning the Costa Rican lottery. Despite our discussion with a Commerce Fraud Bureau agent, and Mike Marvin, the chief of our special agent force, is here with us today, despite having talked to our special agent, the client remained convinced she had won the $4 million lottery. So what did we do? The department contacted the client's bank, which froze her account to stop the transfer of money to Costa Rica. The client called a few weeks later to thank the department, acknowledging that she had been duped, she was the victim of a fraud. Save her money. So these are just the tip of the iceberg. We do this a lot. I'll have to say I can tell you another case of the just like the Costa Rican lottery where we're working with. Yeah.
Commissioner, I apologize, but we're kind of running out of time because I was too nice to Representative Davids earlier. But if you could, we have another testifier and we have several questions for you or for Representative Rosenthal.
Sure, I'll wrap it up.
Thank you, Commissioner. My apologies.
I just want to make sure that people understand that we're working with financial institutions. They're doing great things. But oftentimes there's a lot of bad apples out there. We all understand we want to try to fight this, and we think that this would be clearly the resources would be a leg up to help us do this. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. George? Welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and start whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. Mary Jo George with AARP Minnesota. I certainly hate to cut Commissioner Rothman off because I probably, too, have some stories I wanted to share, but I'll be brief. I am the advocacy director at AARP Minnesota, and fighting fraud is a top priority for us at AARP. We work in partnership with the Department of Commerce, law enforcement agencies, and nonprofits because it does take both a collaborative and a multidisciplinary approach to fight fraud. But we do think additional investments are necessary, and I do think this idea of a campaign that would include both radio and TV is so important for many of the isolated seniors that we have talked about. I think Commissioner Rothman and Representative Rosenthal, both of you have kind of outlined like that seniors really are at risk, and the truth is that the majority of people being targeted don't realize how vulnerable they are and how misinformed they are about their risk for identity theft and financial crime. But tragically, I think Commissioner Rothman addressed it, what we see is many of these schemes are falling on seniors who are alone and isolated, and even when they have a victim support system, the con artist or the shame at having fallen for the victim really isolates them from their family. And so I think if they can, you know, if we can continue to reach people in a number of ways, I think that we can do a lot better. In the interest of time, I won't share our stories, but just to have you know that we hear daily from people being scammed out of these Jamaica fraud scams and just other third-party perpetrators who really are very sneaky, and we have to do a better job of keeping up on it because it changes fast and rapidly. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. George. Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a couple questions for the commissioner, if I could.
He's coming back up, Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you. And first of all, thank you, Representative Rosenthal, for bringing this up. It is a very important bill. I think it's the right idea. Just some clarification, Commissioner. And so, Mr. Chair, to the commissioner, are you pursuing these now? It sounds like you are.
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kreshaw.
Mr. Chair, yes, we are.
aggressively?
Yes.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Crucia.
Okay, so to that point, so if you're pursuing these aggressively, why is $500,000 the right number to make you more aggressive?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crucia, let me clarify. When we get a complaint or a problem on a senior fraud or claim, we investigate, we take after those people aggressively, we make sure that we leave no stone unturned. When we devote our resources to be able to go out and do an event at Apple Valley or Rochester before, we can only do so much. We can't get around the state as much as we'd like to, and as much as people ask. So what we do is we collaborate with Better Business Bureau, we collaborate with the with AARP, we collaborate with Triad, in fact, the Sheriff's Association, and a number of other institutions around the state, county attorneys, as many as we can. But we can't get everywhere. And so the idea of this is to get to the airwaves by PSA, to be able to sort of do an air campaign in a way, but then also to support some additional activity that we are already doing, but to do it in a broader fashion.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Crucia.
Thank you. And last one, what wouldn't you do if this money wasn't allocated? What wouldn't you be able to do?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we wouldn't be able to do the PSA campaigns, and we would be limited to just the resources that we do have to be able to do this. So we would continue to try to get the word out. Again, it's about not waiting until it happens, but try to get the word out. Consumer alerts, do these kinds of events, but not to the extent that we could with the additional funding.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Crucia, you're good.
Just a final word. So I just have a question on the $500,000. I mean, I want to make sure that that's right. I mean, this is a problem, but is this the arbitrary number that's going to take care of this? I just would like a little bit more clarification on that, and I can take that offline.
Thank you, Representative Crucia. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Rosenthal, for carrying this bill. The question that I have is, I prosecute financial exploitation of vulnerable adult cases. That's the kind of law I practice. And so my question is, all of this discussion seems to be around third party, kind of that stranger danger kind of attitude. The majority of cases that I see are actually friends or family members who are doing the financial exploitation. So what do you plan to do in this campaign to not just make this what we all have come to see in other areas of the law, that is stranger danger, when the majority of perpetrators I see are actually friends and family?
Commissioner Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, that's an excellent question. When we do these the events like yesterday and on Friday, we call out and say exactly what you just said, which is that it's not necessarily a professional or whatever, but it's affinity fraud. It's a family member. It's affinity fraud. And it can be, as you said, somebody who they know personally. It could be somebody in a social group that they know. It could be an attorney. It could be a lot of different people who are in a position of trust to abuse the financial situation of the person. So when we train, for example, so when we go out and talk to the seniors, we say that. And they know that. And as Mary Jo had just said, there's this shame factor in reporting it. So what we're trying to do is say to you seniors, you know what's happening. To the extent, just report it, let us know. But we do target the issue about affinity fraud that you're talking about. And then we do everything we can to train professionals and to talk to the financial institutions. We talk to the credit unions. We have a training session for financial planners. We have training sessions for banks, tellers, all of them, to look for and spot affinity fraud because it's not just coming from Costa Rica.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the final question that I have then is, so given that we know that a lot of this financial exploitation is not third party but is within the family, other than kind of the training of institutions and folks that you regulate, why is the Department of Commerce the proper entity to be doing the statewide training and the statewide education on this issue? It's my understanding that Channel 2 did a movie on abuse, neglected, and alone. That was a partnership of a nonprofit and a county attorney and law enforcement. There is the Vulnerable Adults Justice Project, their AARP. My question is, why this $500,000? And then what is it that you plan to do with it? Are you going to contract with others to do it? Are you just going to do this campaign? How are you going to know that you're reaching the target audience, and how are we going to know that you've been effective in doing it? It's my understanding that there are currently senior fraud toolkits, and why is your senior fraud toolkit going to be better than the ones that I've seen?
Commissioner Rothman. Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I don't know if you've seen ours. We're happy to show it to you and to work with you about seeing it, but it's excellent. We have worked with national experts at the federal, state level, local, and with all the institutions, AARP, Better Business Bureau, with the Elder Justice Center and others. And we train with them. It's not just ours, but we train with them, and we utilize everybody's expertise. With respect to what we would do, again, our goal is to develop the materials we have, not only what we have, but also to expand and to deliver them better, to get them out to people. Other states do have had resources to do PSAs. So, for example, Montana even has had it. But we don't have the resources here, and we don't have the department to do a PSA. So there are examples. It's easy to do, whether they did it as a third-party vendor to help or whatever. Our staff has the ability to do that and work with them. We have a good communications team. On the first question you asked, it's the public interest to do this. It's absolutely necessary. There's no other state agency that's better than the department, I believe, on financial abuse. To know what it is, to understand what it is, and to be able to educate the public about it. I do know that, and we will work with and have worked collaboratively with the Department of Human Services and others, the counties in their social services areas, as you mentioned. We train with them. I go on the websites with them and do web trainings. Not to go on, but I believe there's no other state agency that is so focused on the financial abuse of senior citizens as the Department of Commerce.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Hillstrom. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do believe this is the place to have this because Commerce investigates financial fraud. And so you're the one to come in and take care of that. And Representative Rosenthal, thank you for this bill. I think it's a very good bill, and we need to do it. And Commissioner, when you talked about Mr. Rod, what I do in real life is I'm a financial planner, and I do a lot of retirement planning. I get calls from the carriers I work with when they see a problem, and they send me out there. And I was sent out on the Rod case to the Redwood Falls area. And how much time is he going to do? It better be a lot.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, how much? What did he get sentenced to?
Let me look. I don't.
Commissioner Rothman?
Let me just look at the top of my head here.
While the commissioner's looking it up, I know Representative O'Driscoll had a short question. Why don't we go to that question for the author, Representative O'Driscoll?
Very quickly, Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Rosenthal, you're in the right direction. Commissioner, I appreciate you being here today. Commissioner, yes or no, has the governor included this provision in his budget for fiscal 2018?
Representative Rosenthal, do you know that?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I do not know that.
Commissioner, do you know if that's in the budget, governor's budget recommendation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, it's not.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I don't have it at the top. I used to know, but off the top of my head.
We can go offline, but this is very, very serious stuff. They are destroying people's lives, and if we can get to people at the early stages where some of this can be stopped, and that's what I do, is I'm able to stop a lot of this, can't stop it all. But I think this bill, House File 879, is headed right down the right direction, and thank Representative Rosenthal for bringing this bill.
Thank you, members, for a good discussion. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anybody rushing down, Representative Rosenthal will give you the final word on your bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. While this bill does not solve every case and every incident, it's a step in the right direction,
That's very, very important. I think all of us get phone calls at home, at least I do, saying, I'm calling to reduce your credit card rate. And I say, what credit card? And they said, all of them. And then I tell them, I don't have a credit card. And they hang up the phone. And this is getting worse and worse and worse, whether it's credit card, somebody hacked into your computer. These things are getting more and more sophisticated. So I ask for your support, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. With that, Representative Rosenthal renews his motion that House File 879 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
And we are adjourned.